Woman House.
Woman House.
Woman House.
Woman House.
Woman House.
Words belong to each other, although of course only a great poet knows that the word incarnadine belongs to multitudinous seas.
Virginia Woolf was born in London in 1882 and took her life in her home in Sussex in 1941. She was a Londoner. She loved the city and all of the possible meetings, exchanges and social life that it offered. This was the subject of her novel, Mrs. Dalloway, published in 1925. Yet her health was fragile, and psychiatrists of the time insisted she have a calm and isolated existence for her mental stability. When they did not commit her to psychiatric institutions, as had been the case on several occasions in the early 1910s, they encouraged her to move away from the city, and she experienced these more or less traumatic constraints as a kind of confinement. This does not contradict her search for a room or a place of one's own. In other words, an enclosed and personal space, the necessary condition in her eyes for a woman to be able to create, and which she revealed in her essay, A Room of One's Own, published in 1929. This tension between the interior of the house and even within the house, the interior of the room, and the outside world, urban or natural, runs through her entire body of work. This tension can be seen simply in the titles of her work, such as The Voyage Out, Jacob's Room, and To the Lighthouse. It is from this book, my favourite, published in 1927, that I have chosen to read a few excerpts. Virginia Woolf was inspired by happy memories, those of the summers she spent with her family in St. Ives, Cornwall, in a house facing the sea, until her teenage years and the death of her mother. She moves this setting to Scotland and tells about a day in the summer of 1910, a large family, and a plan for a sailing boat trip in the first section. In the third and final part of the book, we find the surviving members of this same family in the same house, one day in the summer of 1920, where this outing will finally take place. Between the two, a short section, entitled Time Passes, describes the intervening decade solely from the point of view of this beloved and deserted house, which awaits the return of those who inhabited it, which narrowly escapes annihilation, and which finally comes to life again, thanks in particular to the work of the cleaning lady, Mrs. McNab, who was instructed by her bosses to reopen the house. Nothing stirred in the drawing room or in the dining room or on the staircase. Only through the rusty hinges and swollen, sea-moistened woodwork, certain airs, detached from the body of the wind, the house was ramshackle, after all, crept round corners and ventured indoors. Almost, one might imagine them as they entered the drawing room, questioning and wondering, toying with the flap of hanging wallpaper, asking, would it hang much longer? When would it fall? Then, smoothly brushing the walls, they passed on musingly, as if asking the red and yellow roses on the wallpaper whether they would fade, and questioning, gently, for there was time at their disposal, the torn letters in the waste paper basket, the flowers, the books, all of which were now open to them, and asking, were they allies? Were they enemies? How long would they endure? So, some random light directing them, with its pale footfall upon stair and mat, from some uncovered star or wandering ship, or the lighthouse even, with its pale footfall upon stair and mat, the little heirs mounted the staircase and nosed round bedroom doors. But here surely they must cease. Whatever else may perish and disappear, what lies here is steadfast. Here, one might say that those sliding lights, those fumbling airs that breathe and bend over the bed itself, here you can neither touch nor destroy. Upon which, wearily, ghostlily, as if they had feather-light fingers and the light persistency of feathers, they would look once on the shut eyes and the loosely clasping fingers and fold their garments wearily and disappear. And so, nosing, rubbing, they went to the window on the staircase, to the servants' bedrooms, to the boxes in the attics, descending, blanched the apples on the dining room table, fumbled the petals of roses, tried the picture on the easel, brushed the mat, and blew a little sand along the floor. At length, desisting, all ceased together, gathered together, all sighed together, all together gave off an aimless gust of lamentation, to which some door in the kitchen replied, swung wide, admitted nothing, and slammed to. So, with the house empty, and the doors locked, and the mattresses rolled round, those stray heirs, advance guards of great armies, blustered in, brushed bare boards, nibbled and fanned, met nothing in bedroom or drawing room that wholly resisted them, but only hangings that flapped, wood that creaked, the bare legs of tables, saucepans and china, already furred, tarnished, cracked. What people had shed and left, a pair of shoes, a shooting cap, some faded skirts and coats in wardrobes. Those alone kept the human shape and, in the emptiness, indicated how once they were filled and animated, how once hands were busy with hooks and buttons, how once the looking glass had held a face, had held a world hollowed out in which a figure turned, a hand flashed, the door opened, in came children rushing and tumbling and went out again. Now, day after day, light turned like a flower reflected in water, its sharp image on the wall opposite. Nothing, it seemed, could break that image, corrupt that innocence, or disturb the swaying mantle of silence which, week after week in the empty room, wove into itself the falling cries of birds, ships hooting, the drone and hum of the fields, a dog's bark, a man's shout, and folded them round the house in silence. Once only, a board sprang on the landing. Once, in the middle of the night, with a roar, with a rupture, as, after centuries of quiescence, a rock rends itself from the mountain and hurtles crashing into the valley, one fold of the shawl loosened and swung to and fro. Then, again, peace descended and the shadow wavered, light bent to its own image and adoration on the bedroom wall. And Mrs. McNab, tearing the veil of silence with hands that had stood in the washtub, grinding it with boots that had crunched the shingle, came as directed to open all windows and dust the bedrooms. And now, in the heat of the summer, the wind sent its spies about the house again. Flies wove a web in the sunny rooms. Weeds that had grown close to the glass in the night tapped methodically at the window pane. When darkness fell, the stroke of the lighthouse, which had laid itself with such authority upon the carpet in the darkness, tracing its pattern, came now in the softer light of spring, mixed with moonlight, gliding gently, as if it laid its caress, and lingered stealthily, and looked, and came lovingly again. But in the very lull of this loving caress, as the long stroke leant upon the bed, the rock was rent asunder. Another fold of the shawl loosened. There it hung and swayed. Through the short summer nights and the long summer days, when the empty rooms seemed to murmur with the echoes of the fields and the hum of flies, the long streamer waved gently, swayed aimlessly, while the sun so striped and barred the rooms and filled them with yellow haze, that Mrs. McNab, when she broke in and lurched about, dusting, sweeping, looked like a tropical fish, oaring its way through sun-lanced waters. The place was gone to rack and ruin. Only the lighthouse beam entered the rooms for a moment, sent its sudden stare over bed and wall in the darkness of winter, looked with equanimity at the thistle and the swallow, the rat and the straw. Nothing now withstood them. Nothing said no to them. Let the wind blow. Let the poppy seed itself and the carnation mate with the cabbage. Let the swallow build in the drawing room and the thistle thrust aside the tiles, and the butterfly sun itself on the faded chintz of the armchairs. Let the broken glass and the china lie out on the lawn and be tangled over with grass and wild berries. For now had come that moment, that hesitation, when dawn trembles and night pauses, when, if a feather alight in the scale, it will be weighed down. One feather, and the house, sinking, falling, would have turned and pitched downwards to the depths of darkness. In the ruined room, picnickers would have lit their kettles. Lovers sought shelter there, lying on the bare boards. And the shepherd stored his dinner on the bricks. And the tramp slept with his coat round him to ward off the cold. Then the roof would have fallen. Briars and hemlocks would have blotted out bath, step, and window, would have grown unequally but lustily over the mound, until some trespasser, losing his way, could have told only by a red-hot poker among the nettles or a scrap of china in the hemlock that here, once, someone had lived, there had been a house. If the feather had fallen, if it had tipped the scale downwards, the whole house would have plunged to the depths, to lie upon the sands of oblivion. But there was a force working.
Woman House is a podcast produced by Aware with the support of Belinda de Godemar. Directed by Elodie Royer. Original music by Andrew Nelson.